temptation and decided it was just simply not possible. So I've decided to focus on the offshore wind resource assessment side of things. So this is mostly from the final chapter of my thesis, where I'm trying to assess whether synthetic aperture radar can be a useful tool for assessing offshore wind speeds and offshore wind speed distributions. So the structure of my talk, I'm going to give you a bit of background to why I'm doing this research, about why we're interested in offshore wind farms. Some introductory material about my research. So first off, looking at the retrieval algorithm to retrieve surface wind fields from SAR data, looking at the evaluation and the accuracy of this, and then moving on to some of the derived wind resource assessments and whether SAR can offer a useful tool in this context. And then the final thing I'm putting in here is quite an interesting thing that came out of my thesis, which was potentially the influence of mountain waves upon surface wind fields seen from SAR. So that was something that I found quite interesting that I thought I'd like to bring up with you here. And today my talk is focusing on this study area, which is the IRAC of the UK. So that's where we're working. Most of my data covers this portion of the IRAC, and particularly is focusing on Liverpool Bay. And as you'll see, this is for a number of reasons, not least because there's an awful lot of wind farms planned and currently operational in this area. I'll talk about that in a second as well. So the first question is, what's the state of the offshore wind industry? It's very interesting because when I started my thesis, there was relatively little momentum. There was a few planned offshore wind farms. There was this intention of the government to meet 10% of the UK's energy by 2010 from renewable sources. But at the start, it looked like things were potentially going to take off. As my thesis has progressed, this industry has gathered momentum more and more rapidly with every year. So it's been very interesting to me to see this happening throughout the course of the last 4 years. So, say it's a major growth area is the installation and running of offshore wind farms. Compared to land, the advantages of an offshore wind farm, well, it's a greater wind resource. One reference I've said and is often quoted suggests that at 30 metres above the sea surface, there is 25% higher, 25% greater wind resource than there is on land, a distance of 10 kilometres offshore. I don't know how reliable that figure is, but it's one that's often bandied about. And the other advantage to an offshore wind farm is that you can install more turbines and larger turbines offshore than is technically feasible on land for issues to do with public, what people will tolerate next to their house, I guess, basically. There's three rounds of development planned, and currently we're in the first round, which is the kind of the demonstrator of the testbed phase. So most of the turbine arrays we're seeing at the moment are relatively small compared to the developments planned in the future. And it's projected to represent 40% of the renewable sector by 2015. So that's something I got from the British Wind Energy Association for 2007. So the blue slice of the pie there is the offshore wind as of 2007, 4% of the renewable sector. By 2015, it's projected to make up a sizable chunk. So it is a fast-growing and important sector of the UK's energy. And this is where they're currently planned. Red turbines show that there's wind farms operating. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 at the last count I made are currently working. Yellow is ones that are in different stages of being planned, consented, and set for the future. You'll notice that the vast majority are around the English coast in the three strategic areas, the Irish Sea, the Greater Wash, and the Thames Estuary. In Scotland, we have two projects. This is the Aberdeen Bay one, which is nominally an offshore wind farm, but it's pretty close to the shore, as I understand it. And then this is a very interesting one, Beatrix Demonstrator. It's the first deep water turbine. So a pair of these turbines in 50 metre deep water, I believe, which is the deepest water they've actually managed to install these things. Most are in 20 to 30 metre deep water. It's very interesting because what they're doing at Beatrice is they're trying to see if they can use the existing oil and gas infrastructure for placing very, very big deep water turbines off of. And I think that's looking like it's a success. So in the future, there will be a lot more deep water large turbines planned. So that's an interesting one if you're interested to go and have a look at. This is an example of a fairly standard offshore turbine. So it's a 2 megawatt Vestas turbine. It's the, I guess, the industry standard. So tower height, 80 meters above the sea surface, blade diameter, 90 meters. Doesn't mean very much when you look at it, those figures. But if I show you the size of the installation vessel next to a turbine, you begin to get an idea of quite how large these structures are, and quite how much of a difference these will make to the offshore environment. I would reckon that the London Eye is probably not far off the height from the sea surface to the tip of the blades. So you're looking at something which is probably as massive as the London Eye. That's pretty impressive, really, particularly if you're looking at installing hundreds of these off the coast of the UK. So it's potentially going to be make quite a difference to the way that we see and we use and we manage our coastal waters. So, what are the economics of actually installing and running an offshore wind farm? I've simplified this a lot, just to kind of get some of the key issues that we're looking at here. So we've got this idea, we've got the cost of extraction, so all the costs to actually get the wind farm out and to operate it, versus the amount of energy that we can extract at a given site. Capital costs are perhaps the greatest limitation. It costs an awful lot to design, install, maintain. Different types of seabed will require different types of foundations, which will introduce, again, different costs. You've also got transmission. Actually connecting an offshore turbine to the grid, taking it onshore, is another major cost. And that's why we're seeing wind farms concentrated in strategic areas, because if you build one grid infrastructure, you can put an awful lot of wind farms off that same thing. This is why they're being concentrated in those areas, along with other reasons. So those are two of the key costs. Energy produced, well, it's one of the things is the amount of time that the turbine is running. That's determined by maintenance. If the turbine breaks a lot, you're not going to be able to extract much energy. So you want to ideally have a turbine running for a long period. You have the wind resource. The available energy is strongly related to the wind speed. So there's a power law there which says that the available wind energy is related to the cube of wind speed. So the amount of wind you can extract rises exponentially with wind speed. So that's why wind speed and the wind resource is such an important factor. And then the turbine efficiency. Generally speaking, larger turbines are more efficient. Again, this is why offshore wind is quite exciting, quite useful. To focus in on wind resource, which is what I'm talking about here, this is a graph I found from a paper in 2003. It's from a guy called Sahin, which basically schematically shows the influence of site mean wind speed at hub height against the price range of energy. I'm not going to go into how accurate or not this graph is, but the interesting thing is the suggestion that of the different types of wind energy you have, offshore is most expensive by a long way. But it also, if you have small differences in hub height mean wind speed, you introduce large differences in the amount your energy costs. So this shows a 3 meter a second difference in wind speed indicates offshore energy. In this case, he estimated it goes from being a quarter more expensive than nuclear to being roughly the same as or less than the cost of nuclear energy per unit. I guess just indicative of the sort of trends we're looking at here. Wind speed has a big impact upon the economic feasibility of a wind farm. So it's very important to have a good understanding of what the wind resource is at any potential site. Not least because before you can get the capital from an investor to build a wind farm, you have to have a robust idea of what the wind resource is at that site. So it's a very important parameter to assess. How do we assess it? Well, the obvious one is you stick an anemometer there on an offshore mast. So it's the
the industry gold standard, I guess, is to put an offshore mast at a potential site or at the centre of a group of potential sites to be monitoring the long-term mean wind speed at that site and also the wind speed distribution. But I know that it has no spatial coverage to get to expand the wind speeds from this site to the surrounding area. We'll use different types of flow models. Something called WASP is one that's quite often used. It's a wind atlas, it's called. And it will basically take the observations at this site from other sites nearby to try and build up what the spatial picture of the wind field is. The other problem with installing a mast is that there isn't much of an already existing network offshore of masts. And if we're saying in 2005 that we want to build a wind farm in 2008, we need to start getting quite quickly an idea of what the wind speed is there. But if you've only got 6 months to a year of observations from this mast, it doesn't tell you really much information about the long-term trend at that site. So this is one of the other issues with using in-situ observations, is that you've got to find some way of relating the observations over that period to the long term. There's plenty of methods to do that. But anyway, so that's in-situ observations. One other thing that might be, I'm showing numerical weather prediction here, but there could be different types of models that you would use to get an idea of what the long-term mean wind speed is at the site. Generally speaking, they've got an operation model will have quite a good temporal resolution. For example, the UK Mesoscale model runs four times a day. It has a resolution of 10 kilometres. There's a new 4-kilometre mode coming online, but it's not yet available for academic use, as far as I'm aware. So numerical models are a very good source of information. But as I say, you're getting quite a generalised view of what the surface wind field is. And the other thing I'm going to talk about here is synthetic aperture radar. I will note that scatterometers, for those of you who know better, scatterometers are not going to talk about in this context, because scatterometers have a resolution of 15, 20, 25 kilometres and they don't operate well near to shore. Whereas synthetic aperture radar is high resolution, it can get in close to shore, and there's 15 years up plus of satellite observations available from this instrument. But this challenge is in actually retrieving the surface wind field from this data. And that's what I'm going to be talking about for most of this talk. And there's a lot of techniques out there, but it's still relatively unproven, I would say, in the field of offshore wind farm development. Developers that I've spoken to still don't quite believe in this technique. So that's interesting, and we'll talk about that more later. So this is an example of the sort of data you'll get from a synthetic aperture radar. It's an active microwave instrument. This means it's sending out pulses of energy and measuring the strength of the reflected or backscattered signal. So we have a satellite which is flying down an orbit on this side of the image. It's sending a side-looking pulse of energy measuring the response. The brighter the pixel, the stronger the reflected energy. Generally speaking, the rougher a target is, the stronger your response will be. So areas that are, such as urban areas, have lots of nice corners facing towards the antenna, so you get a nice strong response from it. Forest you might get a good response from, open grassland less so. Over the ocean though, most of our roughness has been generated by the surface wind. So because surface wind and surface roughness are coupled, backscatter over the ocean is also related to the surface wind field. Particularly we're interested in the small capillary waves, which respond very quickly to surface wind speed. So the waves in the sea surface that are in the order of 5 to 10 centimetres for this satellite, which is ERS, so NVSAT, is what will be responding most strongly to backscatter. So that, very briefly, what's happening here is that if you're looking in this area, the dark bits are areas of low wind speed with low surface roughness. And then you're beginning to see some wind patterns in here. Also, you'll be seeing oceanic effects in there as well, which we need to account for. And interestingly, over on this side, these odd patterns here are storm cells. So you're seeing effects from the downdraft at the centre of a large storm system, creating these very characteristic imprints on the image. You see them occasionally. I've got about three or four images that have these in them, but I'm not particularly interested in them for my purposes. So if we have this technique, and I want to apply it in the field of offshore wind farm development, the first thing I wanted to do was to sit down and say, right, if I want to examine the use of this technique, let's set some criteria that tells me how successful this technique is going to be. What criteria am I going to judge whether it works or not by? So the first one I decided was accuracy. We want to be able to A, assess how accurate the static aperture radar is, and B, get an idea of is it appropriate for the offshore industry, is the accuracy we can achieve with this technique appropriate for wind farm development. Spatial resolution, there's a lot of products that are quite coarse resolution, and the advantage of synthetic aperture radar is that it can give us fine resolution information about the surface wind field. So we want to say, well, I said that I want the information to be at or below the scale of a wind farm. So around about the 1 to 2 kilometre mark was the resolution I was aiming for. We also want the SAR data to show us something new and relevant. So it should offer something new and useful that we can't achieve through other techniques. And we want to assess or get an idea of how cost effective a technique is it going to be. For an industrial client, this I think is going to be one of the key things, is does it offer us something cost effective that we couldn't achieve through other methods, or is it cheaper than other methods? So those are the sorts of questions I wanted to answer. So first off, I'm going to talk a little bit about the actual method of retrieving a wind field from SAR, so developing the retrieval algorithm. So we have this idea that wind over the sea surface generates waves at different wavelengths, but we're most interested in the surface carry waves from about 5 to 10 centimetres. So surface roughness, the stronger the surface roughness, the greater our backscattered signal will be. So generate an image like that. Now I say that it's the wind speed, but there's also a component of wind direction here. Because the backscatter is going to be strongest if you're looking directly into the wind, and weakest if you're looking at right angles to the wind. So that adds a complicated factor, or a complication on here. We can't simply take our brightness value and take the SAR geometry and retrieve the wind speed. There's two parameters that we're dealing with, wind speed and wind direction. And this is an example of a retrieval model. So we have our backscatter on this axis, wind speed on this axis, the relative wind direction on that axis. And it shows that backscatter is highest for a given wind speed when we're looking into the wind as when we're looking across the wind. So that's a problem. It's an underdetermined problem. We have one observation, so say backscatter maybe of 0 dB is the measured brightness, measured backscatter, and two unknowns, wind speed and wind direction. So from any one observation in the SAR image, we know that our solution lies somewhere on here, but we can't say where. And that's, for a single backscatter value, that's quite a large range of potential wind speeds you're looking at here. So you've got to find some way to introduce something else to solve this problem. So we get this by introducing some external information about the surface wind field to help us narrow down where our backscatter and our, to help us narrow down the surface wind speed and wind direction. The classic approach is simply to say, we'll take an external wind direction, say from the numerical weather prediction model. We'll take our observed backscatter value, overlay the two in some manner, and the solution must be at the intersection of these two things. So say we have a wind direction of 45 degrees, a backscatter of 0 dB, there can only be one solution. Very simple, effective, an awful lot of techniques out there use it. But there are some inherent flaws with this. First of all, it assumes that the variation we're seeing in the image is only due to wind speed changes. It assumes that the external information, such as numerical weather prediction data, captures accurately and correctly what the surface wind direction field is doing. That may not be the case. It may be right at the scale of 10 kilometres, but there might be small-scale fluctuations below that scale that is influencing the SAR data, but we're not accounting for here in this solution. The other thing is that there's errors on this. There's errors on the a priori, and there's errors on the observations, and we're not accounting for that. It assumes that the a priori data and the observation are both true, and that's not great. So what I've done is looked at using a Bayesian retrieval method. So a thing called maximum a posteriori probability. Very simply put, we say we have an observation, we have an a priori, wind speed and direction, and we have some uncertainty on both. We do whatever the uncertainty is, so you basically say that, well, we know that there might be a probability of our a priori being in this region, greater probability of it being here than out here. And the same in the observation, we say that it's most likely for our observation to lie here, but the errors on that mean that, well, the observation might really be over here or over here. And that allows us to say that our solution, so the retrieved wind speed and direction, should be somewhere between these two, somewhere between the observation and the a priori data. I don't intend to go into detail about how you set that problem up, but only to get this notion that it makes it a bit more fuzzy. It gives you the idea that we have the a priori data and the observational data, and our solution lies somewhere between the two. And you try to set up the problem so it finds the optimal weighting of these different types of data to give you a retrieved wind vector. So that's the theory. I can't claim complete credit for this. There's been some other Bayesian retrieval methods, but I'd like to say that mine's probably better. We'll see in the Viva whether people believe that or not. I've run some sensitivity analysis on this, which is where you basically say, I'll take the problem, simulate the condition given known wind speed, wind direction and observations, and then add in some random error onto one of our variables and see what happens when we retrieve wind speed given that random error. So here we have the classic algorithm, directional wind speed algorithm. Here we have mine, the map algorithm. And the main thing to take from this is that when you introduce error on the wind direction and on the observations, the directional wind speed algorithm is far more sensitive to input errors because it can't deal with any idea of uncertainty on that. Whereas the map algorithm, when we introduce an error in the wind direction, it doesn't go all the way. It kind of constrains the solution by the other bits of information we have. So these plots are showing retrieved wind speed, and basically showing that the DWC algorithm, given these parameters, is twice as sensitive to error, in this case, as the map algorithm, and slightly less sensitive to backscatter errors. It's only an indication of the sensitivity of the algorithms. It's theoretical work, but it was nice to see. It's basically going to run the sensitivity analysis. Yeah, it looks like we might be onto something with the new retrieval method. So the next question is, how does it work in real life when we actually put some data into the problem and try and retrieve surface wind fields from it? So here we took a set of SAR scenes, some numerical weather prediction data from the UK meter-scale model, so that's the operational weather prediction model. 1.5 kilometre retrieval resolution was optimal to... I can talk about that later if you want to know about that, but 1.5 kilometre retrieval was feasible and worked well. So that's these from the bees. We're averaging the backscatter over and retrieving a wind vector for each one of these cells over the Irish Sea. And it's validated against an offshore mast here, which recorded wind speed and direction over 3 years, so from 2004 to the present day. One thing to note here, though, is that Hilbre Island is a coastal mast. It's on a small island. It's not ideal for my purposes. Ideally, what I would want is a mast in the middle of the Irish Sea. It's got, so you've got no interference from land. You've got nice, clear SEER and Vector to do your retrieval from, but I simply could not get access to that data. There are offshore masts run by energy companies, there's one here I know for a fact, but it was impossible to get my hands on that commercial data, so that's why we're using this mast. If anyone knows of any sources of commercial data they can get me, if you speak to me, that might make its way into a paper, but anyway, that's one of the limitations of my analysis here. So this is an example retrieval. We've got our backscatter, we've got the NWP wind field, and we've got two retrieved. So this is the new algorithm, this is the classic algorithm. They don't look that different, but what you will notice is that the map tends to produce something which also shows some of the numerical weather prediction data in it. So it's a fusing of the two, whereas the directional wind speed algorithm tends to find more extreme solutions. The other key thing to notice here is that, so we've got our NWP field that says that the area of high wind speed is over here. But given our observations, we can see that that front system, that weather system, has probably moved more to the west from the time that the numerical weather prediction and the SAR data were gathered. That's the strength of this. It tells us, it gives us a much better synoptic view of what the surface wind field is doing. Doing some regression analysis. So the APRO, the numerical weather prediction wind speeds compared against Hilbert Island. It shows that the numerical weather prediction data tends to quite dramatically underestimate the surface wind speed. That's a known problem with the numerical weather prediction model. But the SAR data produces a slope which is much closer to the in-situ observations. And thankfully, my algorithm shows a very modest improvement over the classic method, but there is an improvement there, so that was nice to see. And the other thing to point out is that, I know this just looks like a random spray of dots, but a lot of the error here might also be from the mast itself, as I say, because it's a coastal mast that's going to be getting influence from the island and from turbulence that way. So anyway, these again were quite promising results. So that allowed me to say, well, we have a retrieval, it seems to work, it seems to offer advantages over the classic retrieval. So I took that and decided to apply it for actually estimating the wind resource. I started to generate some idea of what the offshore wind resource is over the Irish Sea. So I had a total of 103 images over here. And validation data I was using was model data from the UK Wind Atlas, which gives you mean wind speed and power density for 10 kilometre cells at turbine hub heights, that's 80 metres above the sea surface. And also some observations from an offshore platform here, but they weren't very good quality, but they were in use in places as well. So the key indicators we're looking at, first up will be the mean wind speed and also the wind power density, which accounts for the fact that we might have a mean which is generated from an awful lot of samples which are low wind speed and an awful lot of samples which are high wind speed, but don't have much in our ideal optimum generation region, around about 10 to 15 metres a second. There's some sampling problems if you're trying to estimate the parameters from SAR. The first is your data set density. So the length of the observation period is determined by the data you can get. I chose 3 years to get some idea of what the mean period of a long period is, but ideally you want to be looking at 5, 10, 15 years if possible to get a good idea of the long-term generation potential at the site. But the real question is, how are our seams distributed throughout that time period? Because you might get seasonality problems if all your images are from June and July, you don't have many images in the winter. So you want things to be nice and evenly spaced across the whole time set. So this was the number of seams I was working with. So some months I have two images or one image, some months I have seven. There's no clear seasonal problems coming in here, but that was a limitation to consider. One of the key problems with SAR is that the satellites only pass over a site at set times of the day. You get a pass in the morning and a pass in the evening. But that means that you might be introducing problems from the diurnal cycle. If you're on the sampling, say, the sea breeze in the morning and the sea breeze in the evening, you'll be introducing potential problems for your estimated long-term wind distribution. So when I investigated it here, I basically wanted to see what the diurnal pattern is at my offshore site. It showed that there wasn't a huge amount of variation, that's 1 meter a second either side. So that was quite promising, but again, that's something you have to be aware of when using this sort of data. Finally, you've got problems of wind distribution truncation. Backscatter models are not very good at retrieving below 2 meters a second, and that can introduce problems when you're trying to estimate the long-term wind speed. If you're underrepresenting low wind speeds, you might get a biased idea of what the long-term wind speed is at a site. Okay. So, took 103 scenes, retrieved wind speeds for each image, and then took an arithmetic mean of these images, compared it against the wind atlas. At first glance, the SAR is estimating similar mean wind speeds. Again, it's quite promising. What was I was quite disappointed to see, though, is that I was hoping that the SAR would sit there and go, right, we've got an area of persistent low wind speed over, say, Morecambe Bay, and you can see that over a number of images which might not get picked up in the wind atlas or in the numerical weather prediction data. But unfortunately, when you start averaging all these scenes together, you don't tend to see that. And that was what I was hoping to get from the higher resolution data, was persistent areas of differences in the wind field that you might not expect. The other thing that was funny about this was that if you look at this region here, the wind atlas says I've got wind speeds in the region of 6 to 7 metres a second, whereas the SAR is predicting wind speeds up closer to 8 metres a second. And that made me think straight away that there's some persistent bias going on here. I don't think it's the wind atlas estimating low wind speeds in this area, because they specifically talk about that in the generation of this data set and say that we know that there's a danger with numerical weather prediction data of predicting low wind speeds close to shore. So we've used different data to try and estimate the wind speeds in this region, and we think they're robust by comparison against other data sets. So it made me think there's something wrong with a synthetic aperture radar. What happened was that I then decided to take an average of the wind directions for the scenes across the whole of the Irish Sea to see how well am I sampling the wind direction, because of course if you're sampling an awful lot of westerlies, you're going to get stronger winds than you do if you're representing easterlies. You've got this idea of stronger wind speeds associated with winds coming from a westerly direction. And what I found, as I suspected, was that the SAR was overrepresenting winds coming from the west, whereas the numerical weather prediction says that's what our wind distribution or the wind direction should be from the Irish Sea. When we split that down into mean wind speeds per direction sector, you can see that wind speeds from this area here are much higher on average than wind speeds elsewhere. So that was overly biasing the picture. Taking a weighted average though, where I basically weighted each individual SAR scene or each SAR wind direction sector by the probability we would, of that sector we would expect from the numerical weather prediction distribution, we get something far more reasonable in this sector without overly affecting the other wind speeds. The cautionary tale here is that you need to be quite careful when you're selecting your wind directions or selecting your sampling of the climate at the site. It's something that I hadn't actually thought about and went out and read some papers and realised that it's a problem that should perhaps be considered when I was selecting the individual SAR scenes. Was going, right, am I actually making a good sampling of the wind directions and the wind speeds over this period? The other thing was wind power density. Now, I knew that this wasn't going to work very well because I had only 103 scenes, and statistically you need at least 170 to accurately get wind power density. So that wasn't much of a surprise that this didn't work so well. So the end story here was that trying to estimate what this wind speed resource is from the SAR data is that the number of scenes I had worked well for the mean wind speed wasn't great for the wind power density, but that was due to the limitations of only having time to analyze scenes. I think that if you got a lot more images into the database, you might get a better idea of what your wind power density is. That remains to be seen, I guess. So the final question is to move on to the influence of mountain waves, atmospheric gravity waves. These were things that I originally wasn't looking for, but found in a third of my images. So they're generated by airflow over the mountains over stable conditions. They're not currently resolved by the UK and our weather prediction model, because the wavelength of these features is in the region of 8 to 10 kilometres, which is 4 to 10 kilometres, which is considerably smaller than the resolution at which the model works at. You can see it creates this wave downstream of a mountain range, and this model suggests that you can have quite strong fluctuations in the surface wind field underneath this package of waves. And these are the sorts of effects you see in the images. It's these bright bands of high wind speed, dark bands of low wind speed. We know these aren't oceanic effects because you can see them travelling over the Isle of Man in places. If it was oceanic, you'd expect it to be diffracting around the island or being affected in some way by it. So the final question was, what is the implication for something like that? I mean, if you have wind farms all the way across here, and you've got a large atmospheric wave travelling over it, how is that going to affect your wind speed generation across the Irish Sea? So I looked at one event where we had two SAR scenes 3 days apart. Each SAR scene showed quite clear evidence of atmospheric gravity waves. Comet being generated over the mountains of Wales, moving off into the Irish Sea in this direction. I also had data from a wind profiler at the Isle of Man. I was interested to see over this period, what's the atmospheric wind profiler doing? So there we have horizontal wind speed at different altitudes from 0 to 2 kilometres. And this is time on this axis, so the first scene at this time, the second scene fits here. And what this is showing is that you've got regions of very high wind speeds up to 15 metres a second being generated at altitudes of up to a kilometre, then low wind speeds, then high wind speeds up above it. This seems to conform with, or confirm that this is an atmospheric gravity wave travelling over the sea, and that these might well be atmospheric rotors being generated underneath it. So it was nice to see that over this period of 3 days, there's potentially activity happening in between the SAR scenes that we can't sample from the SAR scenes. So that was suggesting that this is some event that's happening over a period of time, and it might have some real influence upon the surface wind field. So that's the rotors there. So when we actually sample a transect across the ocean, what's the variation in wind speed that we see? It's up to 2 to 3 meters a second on these transects. But when you translate that into wind power, although it looks that one of the scenes has only got much smaller variations in wind speed, because of the cube relation between wind speed and available wind power to extract, we can see that in both cases we're seeing quite large fluctuations in wind power available over the sea surface over this event. As far as I'm aware, there's no other real way of actually assessing spatially what's happening with an atmospheric gravity wave as it moves over the sea surface. So there's no other way of actually retrieving that surface wind field. So I think this could be quite useful for getting an idea of how frequent these events are, what the scale of the events are. But there's real questions, though. What SAR can't do is tell us how these events move, or how long they tend to stay around for. It's only a single snapshot. So I think this data could be very useful in that context, but other models will be needed to get a better idea of what's going on. I know there's, I've seen quite a few models recently, high resolution airflow models that are looking at this very question of, can we generate and model an atmospheric gravity wave as it moves across the sea surface and model its effect upon surface wind speed. As far as I'm aware, though, no one's thought about using it in the context of wind farms, so this could be quite useful data. So, returning back to those four criteria I set earlier about can this data be used for offshore wind power? The first question is accuracy. In my case, the data is accurate to about 1.5 meters a second. Other studies suggest that in your absolutely best case, you're only going to get data as accurate to about a meter a second, plus or minus. In the context of offshore wind farm development, from speaking to developers, it's simply not good enough. They don't trust it. At that accuracy, they say that this isn't reliable enough for us, for our means. We want things that are far more accurate. So that's a challenge. The question is, though, over time, does your aggregate mean wind speed, is it good? I think it could be, but I think the accuracy criteria is still to be addressed there. Spatial resolution, well, my research shows that you can do it accurately at 1.5 kilometres resolution, which is definitely capable to resolve mesoscale structures in the atmosphere, so that might be quite useful. So the spatial resolution of the data is appropriate. The novel relevant information. So the key advantage of SAR is the high resolution spatial data you're getting out of these images, potentially the ability to identify mesoscale wind structures. I think that could be very useful. In the future, I'm definitely going to be looking a bit more on the use of this data in that context. Finally, we come to the cost effectiveness. The data that I'm using is from the European Space Agency, ESA, ERS and ASAR sensors, and that costs £400 per seam. So to get a reliable wind power density, which is 170 seams, 200 seams, you're looking at costs of upwards of £70,000. An offshore master has been estimated at £250,000 or more, so SAR is cheaper, but it is giving you a far less accurate picture of the surface wind resource. So the real question is that cost effective? Is that good enough for the wind farm developers? I don't know is the answer. What I do think, though, is that the reason that the seams are so expensive is because of the structuring of the European Space Agency. But if you look at other models, like the American model, you might say, we've collected our data, it's already been paid for its primary purpose. The data in the archive we've all been happy to give out free to commercial companies. The European Space Agency is much tighter with its data. I think there's a real case to be made for some sort of strategic approach to this, of saying, well, we've got this data, it might be useful. How about if we do it at a strategic level, do some wind power assessments offshore using all the data in the archive? Anyway, this is a bugbear of mine, is the cost of the images, and I think that's one of the key blockages for making this data, this technique, cost-effective. So conclusions. Bayesian retrieval approach seems valid and relatively accurate. Dataset density is a critical parameter. With only 100 seams available for my study, it's adequate for mean wind speed, but it's not good for wind power density. And the synoptic windfield maps may be a great use. I've thought up some uses of it. If other people have other ideas for this, please contact me or speak to me about it. The outlook. The wind retrieval side of things is getting easier and easier. Lots of commercial packages in the past year or so have come online to actually take a SAR seam and retrieve a wind field from it. But I think that the current cost per seam in a commercial context is probably prohibitive in this context. Thank you.